My name is Susan Leal, and I am the general manager of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, and I am pleased to welcome you to our summit on climate change. As you know, throughout the country, there is a number of meetings, discussions, probably even other summits on climate change, and you're probably wondering how this one is different, how this one might be more important or is important. And the reason it is different and it is essential because what we have gathered here today are the decision makers for one of our most precious resources, water. Represented here today are the heads of the largest water utilities in the United States. As decision makers, we are responsible for providing water to tens of millions of Americans. We are also pleased to bring together other government leaders and scientists that are experts on the environment, water, and climate change. This gathering is also noteworthy in my perspective, in that we not only will exchange ideas, debate issues around water and wastewater, but we are charged with coming up with action plans. Action plans that will allow us to continue to provide drinking water for millions of Americans for generations to come. So I thank you all for being part of this effort. To kick off our program today, I would like to bring up a member of my commission, the president of our commission, and that is Ryan Brooks. Mr. Brooks, Commissioner Brooks, or President Brooks as he is now known, is the Western Region Vice President of Government Affairs for CBS Outdoor, a leading global media company and is responsible for government and public affairs from California to Texas for that company. He is also a member of the California International Relations Foundation. He provides assistance to the California State Senate in furthering economic, environmental, educational, and cultural exchanges with foreign governments and citizens. President Brooks also served as Director of Administrative Services for the City of San Francisco, where he was responsible for policy and planning for 14 city departments, managing over 300 employees and a budget of $100 million. Please join me in welcoming President Brooks.
Thank you, Susan Leal, and good morning and welcome here. Before I start, I want to thank our General Manager Leal, who's done an extraordinary job here at the San Francisco PUC. And also, I want to recognize two people that just walked in, our Vice President of the Commission, Commissioner Ann Moeller-Kane, and Commissioner Dennis Norman that just arrived. Thank you very much. And I want to echo what Ms. Leal said and welcome everyone to this historic summit here in San Francisco. The next couple of days, we're going to tackle some very tough issues, the issues of global warming, issues of wastewater, hydropower, and electric power in the city. And I'm very proud that California is leading the nation in those efforts. We're leading the nation with our U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer, who chairs the most powerful Committee of the Environment and Public Works, our Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is a leader in reducing greenhouse emissions, and the legislature, our pro tem Senator Don Parada, Assemblymember Fabian Nunez, and Jared Huffman, who you'll hear from later on in the program, and of course, our Mayor Gavin Newsom. Gavin Newsom has been a leader of the environment before it was the sexy thing to do. He's been responsible for putting solar power at Moscone Center, responsible for putting power at San Francisco International Airport, responsible for putting solar power at the wastewater facility in the Bayview Hunters Point. He will be responsible for putting power on our libraries, on our schools, and everywhere possible in the city and county of San Francisco. We're very fortunate that this mayor has been the first mayor to create a climate action plan that will reduce the greenhouse emissions by 20% by the year 2012. This mayor has also been a leader in innovation, and we're looking at creating and harnessing tidal power below our Golden Gate Bridge, and that will be done under Gavin Newsom's leadership. So please put your hands together and give a warm San Francisco welcome to my mayor, our mayor, San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you, Ryan. I'm newly elected, so I've got to now call him Mr. President. Thank you, President Brooks, and I want to thank the commissioners for being here, and, of course, our director, Susan Leal, and recognize her extraordinary leadership in putting this together. As they say, God's delays are not God's denials. We should have been here a decade or so ago, recognizing what we all collectively are recognizing today. I had the great privilege of just getting back a couple days ago from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. And it was quite an extraordinary experience for no other reason than for the first time in the three or so years that I've been there, there was no snow up in the Alps. It was completely green as if we were there during the summertime. And what a backdrop for this year's dominant discussions in Davos around global climate change. And in stark contrast to just 2 years ago, where there were just a few panels like this on the topic. Now, overwhelmingly, the consensus is we have got a crisis of extraordinary proportions, and we need leadership not just to identify the obvious, but to act locally to begin to address it. And indeed, that's the spirit of this conference. It's one thing to talk about ideals. It's another to manifest them. We have got to provide each other best practices. We've got to provide each other specific examples to aggressively address the reality of global warming. Now, that reality is such that we are so focused on talking about what could happen if we continue to do what we've done, we're not talking enough about what we've already done that is happening, that there's nothing we can do to stop. And I think that is the next narrative in this discussion, is the damage we have done in the last half century is such that this conference, regardless of whether or not we take bold leadership in the next months and years ahead, the reality is we're going to be burdened with the mistakes of the past, and we better get serious to begin to address them. So I want to thank each and every one of you for taking the time to come here from Seattle, Los Angeles, New York, all across the country. Interestingly, those coastal cities, appropriately, those coastal cities that are taking the time to be here and begin the process not only of identifying the problem today and working through the consensus, again, sort of sharing the same set of facts which continues to dominate the dialogue, but then begin the process of resolving what we do about this reality tomorrow. That being said, in San Francisco, I'm very proud to be a resident of a city, a fifth-generation resident of a city that has always been a city of dreamers and doers, a city of entrepreneurs, a city of innovators, a city that doesn't just identify these larger global problems but begins to address strategies to solve them. And indeed, San Francisco is very proud of its leadership to begin the process of mitigation so that we don't have to adapt and, as some have said, suffer the consequences of global climate change. More mitigation, less adaption, less suffering. This city decided a number of years ago, after the United States did the obvious, and that was decided not to participate in those Kyoto Accords, to go further, as Ryan was just mentioning, than Kyoto would have required the United States. We want to roll back our CO2 emissions 20% below 1990 levels by 2012, substantially farther along than those Kyoto Accords. The challenge is, how do you do it? And I've gone to a lot of conferences, and you've got mayors saying, well, we've done it. And then I ask, well, what's the methodology that you determine where you were and now where you are? And I realize we're not that sophisticated. in terms of really aggregating that information, registering that information, and really indeed knowing how much we have accomplished. We are anecdotally, but we recognized even in San Francisco that we were having a difficult time determining how far along we were on this path. That's why we have become the first city in the state, and we're very proud of the leadership now in the state. And I say leadership now in the state, not leadership 5 years ago, but now in the state on these issues, by becoming the first city to register where we are in terms of our emissions and having more objective minds determine exactly where we are, so that it's not just a politician coming up and saying we've rolled it back 30% below 1990 and everyone applauds, but the reality is that's not necessarily the case. So we've got a plan of action. We've got a coordinator whose purpose in life is to advance these efforts. We have a Department of Environment whose purpose is to also support the initiation of these efforts. And within that plan, we've got actionable items, some of which are as interesting or at least elevating in terms of a quality of imagination as tidal wave energy or wave energy, which to me is just low-hanging fruit. The idea that Mother Nature has given us all of the tools to solve this riddle, and we're not taking advantage of those tools by focusing appropriately, but almost exclusively on solar and wind and other efforts, and not taking advantage of harnessing the extraordinary power of the energy that could be created because of our tidal flows and the enormous energy that could be generated because of waves. And that's why this city is poised to become the first city in North American history with a demonstration project, a commercial project, to place, in essence, a large green power plant underneath the mouth of our Golden Gate Bridge, or the mouth of the bay below the Golden Gate Bridge, that could conceivably provide enough power for 12.5% of all of the households in San Francisco. 100% green, 100% renewable. They're doing smaller projects around the world, from Israel, and I was just over in England. We've seen these demonstration projects. We've now got to make them more commercially viable, and San Francisco wants to take the lead. My great hope and expectation as a Californian is to see those gas and oil rigs off the coast of California completely replaced with wave energy systems, which again exist around the world but aren't being taken advantage of here in the state of California as they could or should be. We've done a lot on solar. In fact, we're very proud to have taken the leadership on our solar initiative. A number of years ago, the public passed a $100 million solar bond in San Francisco. This is years and years ago, which became the impetus for the Million Solar Roof Initiative that Governor Schwarzenegger, to his credit, advanced a number of years ago and succeeded with a year or so ago. We have the largest municipally owned solar project in the United States of America, just right here over at our Moscone facility. We have 450 other projects throughout San Francisco. We've incentivized, as many cities have wisely, over-the-counter permits so people can quickly and easily navigate the bureaucracy in order to get their solar systems up. $89 fee, for example, flat fee, front of the line, in order to advance their solar efforts. We are developing projects in this city with minimum requirements for LEED building standards. In fact, we have a proposal that I'll be presenting in front of our San Francisco Board of Supervisors that says that if you want to build a commercial structure in excess of 50,000 square feet, you've got to provide minimum LEED standards of construction. And the reason we're doing that is we created an incentive a year ago to do just that, and everybody, in order to get ahead of the queue in terms of the planning process, is jumping in saying that's a no-brainer for us because time matters more than anything else. So we realized we can take it to the next level and just simply require it as a baseline for doing business in the city and county of San Francisco. Now, that follows what we had already done, and that is said if we're going to spend the taxpayers' money, we've got to provide those LEED standards in terms of our libraries, reconstructing our recreation centers, doing it for our institutions, our cultural institutions. For example, the extraordinary job that is currently being done, and hopefully this time next year, will be complete at our Academy of Sciences. Renzo Piano, the great international architect with one of the most sustainable green developments, in fact, the most of any similar type structure in this nation, $180+ million development at that Academy of Sciences LEED Gold standards. We are redeveloping old brownfields in San Francisco, replacing old power plants. We had one of the most polluting power plants in the state of California. We just shut it down, an old PG&E plant, and we're reclaiming those areas by targeting the opportunities to replace all these blue-collar jobs with our green-collar jobs, and focusing not just on environmental justice, but focusing on economic empowerment to the communities that disproportionately have been burdened because of our neglect and focus on this old fossil fuel industrial age economy. And I do believe that the next narrative in this discussion, and I think it's critical that it not just become next, it needs to be intertwined, is how do we reconcile the income inequality that we have in this country and reconcile the lack of empowerment and opportunity that has existed with the old industrial strategies of electricity and fossil fuel production, and begin to address the issues of poverty in the same stead. And I think that is striking in San Francisco, when the vast majority of our pollutants and waste and wastewater system, et cetera, are disproportionately in areas where people have the highest unemployment rate and the lack of resources to truly make their lives as successful and prosperous as we all are trying to achieve. We're a city that has the highest recycling rates. At a time when people said you couldn't have 50% recycling, San Francisco is poised to be at 70% in a year or so. We want to get to 0% by 2020. I think we can do that by 2015. They said that's impossible. They said that you couldn't require, for example, on the development of our Treasure Island. Right there, you'll see an island. Many of you know the region very intimately. We're redeveloping our Treasure Island, 6,000 housing units. It will be the most green and sustainable development in U.S. history. Again, you want to do business in the city, here are the new rules that regulate that intrigue and interest. And we're very proud to have an agreement with the developer, again, to provide that. And that comes from wastewater facilities. It comes from the utilization of photovoltaics and wind and other mechanisms to substantially advance our environmental goals. I can go on and on, and truly, I could go on and on about some of the work we're doing on energy efficiency. Again, back to low-hanging fruit. We're not talking enough about energy efficiency and our power savers programs, our partnerships with the business community, our desire to get rid of incandescent lights exclusively in the city. I know there's a state initiative to do that. We're going to be advancing it much sooner than that. We can do so much more. It's a long-winded way of saying there's no excuse. We have the capacity. We have the quality of imagination. We have the tools. You guys are doing it in your respective cities. We're doing partially in this city. There's no reason we can't lead by example. And when I say lead, I don't mean, again, L-E-A-D, L-E-E-D as well. We have an obligation. You have the capacity. Do not look back at peril of being judged not to have acted on this seminal issue that unites the planet. And I think, and I'll close with this, that Al Gore has summed it up best. Rare is it in human history that we all connect on a purpose greater than our own. This is a remarkable opportunity, not just a crisis, an extraordinary opportunity. And I think we should look at it accordingly. I am optimistic. I am absolutely proud of the progress that our Department of Environment and Susan and this new PUC have accomplished. And I'm wildly enthusiastic about the ideas that will be generated by this two-day conference. And our goal then is to manifest your ideas and make them real. Closing, I'll say one final thing. The politics of this is remarkable. I don't think any of us could imagine 3 years ago we'd be where we are today. There are a few people, save a few folks on these right-wing talk shows that I still are just living, you know, saying it's all about volcanoes or something, and global warming is not man-made, that are just, I mean, it's humiliating. On behalf of their families, I am embarrassed. That being said, the consensus on this is extraordinary. So we have this unique and spirited opportunity, and I'm here to take your ideas, and I think in politics we're nothing more than conduits. My job is to take your ideas and to attempt to try new things. But in turn, and this is my final point, we're willing to take great risks in San Francisco, because I'm convinced the greatest risk is not acting. And we're here to learn from our mistakes. And mistakes will be made and we're committed to making more of them in order to push the bar further. And I encourage you, be it from L.A. or New York or wherever you are, to demand from your executive and legislative branches the same attitude. There's a reason the Silicon Valley area and the San Francisco Bay Area have thrived and prospered. It is that quality of innovation, who at its core is a willingness to try, learn from mistakes, and move forward. Branching and pruning. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Such are the attitudes of the private sector. Now, as it relates to this crisis, we have to take that same ingenuity in the public realm, and that means we need your advice and counsel, and then we need to act, and we need to conclude whether or not we're succeeding and immediately address whether or not that has had an impact and can be shared beyond the 47 square miles that make up our city or the cities that you represent. Thank you all very, very much for being out here. I hope you have a very successful conference. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Mayor, for taking the time out of your very busy day and welcoming everyone here. I'd like to get to work here, and the first thing I'd like to do is call up our first panel and introduce our moderator. And our moderator of our first panel, which is Rising Seas and Coastal Challenges. That moderator of our first panel is Mary D. Nichols. She is currently director of the UCLA Institute of the Environment. She was appointed by Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa to the Board of Water and Power, Commissioners of Los Angeles, and serves as its president through September 2006. We all know Mary as a very capable secretary for California Resources Agency, where she was the head of that agency from 1998 to 2003. And those of us remember back far enough recall the days as a senior attorney for the Environment Now Foundation. She was also co-founder of the first environmental justice working group in the state. We are very pleased here in San Francisco, and I believe all of you should be very pleased to have Mary as the moderator of our first panel. Mary, it's time for you to take it away. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Susan, for that very generous introduction, and also to the city and the Public Utilities Commission for hosting this landmark event. It really is wonderful to see water utilities taking a leadership role in discussing this key issue, and particularly to see the breadth of the program in terms of the way the issues are being addressed. I'm particularly pleased as an urban person to see for once that we're talking about water from the coast up the watershed rather than the other way around, starting out this morning's program dealing with some of the very tough issues that face urban areas as they look not only at water supply, but at water treatment and the energy role that water plays for us as well, both bringing us power and cooling our coastal power plants. I bring you greetings, of course, from the city of Los Angeles, and we are experiencing, as has the entire country, the warmest year recorded. Last summer was the warmest summer since records were kept. I know you've all seen Al Gore's speech, so I don't have to recapitulate all of that, but I do think it's important to bring it back to the meaning for the city of Los Angeles and for other cities as well, that when we record record high temperatures, we also record record high use of our power system, which means we also have record high numbers of outages, and we have record high hours of overtime being worked by our employees, and we have many other impacts that are felt directly by the citizens and by the ratepayers. Our city also receives a very large quantity of water, and certainly our best quality water from a pristine area in the Eastern Sierra known as the Owens Valley. And that's what feeds our aqueduct. And we've been seeing summer runoff over the last 70 years showing a decreasing trend during the peak flow months, which means that although there are ups and downs in terms of the water supply, that during the times of highest need, the water yield is at its lowest and going down. And this finding is consistent with what we've seen from the California Department of Water Resources for the Sacramento River and the San Joaquin River watersheds as well. So we're certainly not alone in this regard. And we're seeing, of course, the decline in the snowpack, which others are going to talk about much more later today. But the suggestion that somehow the snow would be replaced by increasing water rainfall in southern areas has not yet emerged. And so the picture really does not look great. We have our two largest and most important wastewater treatment plants, the Hyperion and Terminal Island plants, located right on the coast. They treat 85% of the city's wastewater and also treat wastewater for 11 neighboring cities and other water agencies, water using agencies throughout the LA area. Those plants are located approximately 20 feet above mean sea level. The projections for sea level rise in the last IPCC report ranged from about 9 to somewhere upward of 25. Latest studies are indicating that the upper numbers are perhaps too conservative. So you can see the implications for the viability of those plants if we don't look at substantial modifications. And again, the science is increasingly telling us that when sea level rises, it doesn't just rise tiny little amounts year by year over a long period of time, that it's very likely that we'll see much more dramatic changes as we've seen with the polar ice cap. We have a number of major baseload natural gas burning generating stations also on the coast. These stations provide upwards of 40% of the total electricity supply of the city, and they are also at about 20 feet above mean sea level. These power plants can be replaced in terms of the amount of energy that they generate, but they are essential to the operation of the grid because of their location. They keep supplies flowing through the power lines in the city. So again, reason why we are preparing now to deal with this effect. City of Los Angeles port is one of the busiest in the United States. It is the busiest in the United States, and with L.A. Long Beach Harbor, one of the busiest in the world. And the port is in the midst of a serious reevaluation of its infrastructure needs based on the effects of global climate change, which, again, we can anticipate, and which are going to require major infrastructure improvements. There's a bridge between areas of the ports that's only a few feet above sea level. Obviously, that bridge will not be functional for much longer into the future. So we are in a mode of looking at prevention, but we are also looking at adaptation because we have no choice. We have to be doing both at the same time. And we also, I think, need to be looking not only at quantity of supplies and things, but also of quality when it comes to our water supply. The aqueduct that supplies Southern California, the State Water Project-owned aqueduct, is also vulnerable to small levels of small amounts of sea level rise, which could breach the levees in the San Francisco, Sacramento Bay Delta region. So we are intimately tied to and connected to that overall city. Our plan is simply to work with everybody we can find, every partner we can find, to try to find ways to address these issues, to help with funding, and to make sure that we are aware of the science, to be doing some proactive planning on our own system, and, of course, to be supporting legislation that will lead to the kinds of dramatic reductions in emissions which will, we hope and trust, help to avert some of the worst impacts of climate change in the future. But the fact is that climate change is not only real, it is in fact happening, and so we are dealing with it right now. The three speakers that are on my panel are all people who are coping in various ways and helping to be part of the solutions. And I'm going to just briefly introduce all three of them in order. You have their biographies in your booklet, so I won't read them to you. I'll simply point out, if you can't read the name tags, that to the left of where I'm sitting on the panel, or to your right, is Will Travis, the executive director of the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, well known around here. I'm one of many people who were proud to pretend to be his boss over the years. And to his left is David Baumforth, senior principal engineer with MWH, Montgomery Watson Harjo, a major international engineering consulting firm with offices. He's with their office outside of London, and they do work for us as well. And the last speaker will be Tom Franza, who is the assistant general manager of the wastewater enterprise for San Francisco PUC. Each of them is going to speak briefly. We will then have some questions, I think, among the panelists and a little bit of discussion. But our goal is to leave a minimum of half an hour for interaction with the audience. So we'll try to get on with it briskly here, starting with Will.
Thanks so much, Mary. First off, what I would like to do is acknowledge somewhere out in the audience is Leslie Lako of our staff. Leslie, could you stand up if I can find you? There she is. Leslie Lako is the creator and manager of the project that we have at BCDC to deal with climate change and sea level rise. And as usually is the case, she does all the work, and so, of course, I get invited to speak. I want to make it clear that any errors, omissions, oversight, or inappropriate comments are my responsibility. Any facts, solid analysis, and clear logic belong to Leslie. Leon Panetta likes to tell the story about the learned professor and scientist who's on the rubber chicken circuit making speeches about a particular subject. And the university provides a driver to him as he goes to these talks. And the driver typically sits in the back of the room and listens. And they're on their way to a presentation. And the driver says, you know, Professor, I've heard your presentation so many times, I think I could give it. Well, the professor, always being interested in a good experiment, says, fine, let's try it. So they get to the auditorium, and the driver takes off his chauffeur's hat. The professor puts it on. The professor sits in the back of the room. And the driver gets up and gives a very highly articulate and persuasive speech, at the end of which some smart-ass reporter, probably a science writer from the Chronicle, asks a very erudite, complex technical question. The speaker looks at him and says, that's the dumbest question I have ever heard. And the answer is so simple, I'm going to ask my driver to explain it to you. So in today's play, Leslie Lako plays the role of the driver. I think we have to acknowledge that the members of the public are at quite different stages in their understanding of climate change and how to deal with it. And I think some of these different stages involve, first, those who are simply ignorant of the issue. They just don't know a thing about it. Now, fortunately, I know we don't have anyone here in that category. There's also a group of people who are simply unwilling to listen because Al Gore is the main messenger. Their view, and I think there's few of them in the Bay Area, but I do know some, their view is, I didn't vote for him, so he has to be wrong. I think there are others that are convinced because Al Gore is the messenger. Those are the folks who say, I voted for him, so he has to be right. And I saw his movie, and it scared the crap out of me, but I don't know what to do other than change my light bulbs. I think there are some that are concerned, but they're skeptical. They say we need more scientific study. We need to consider both sides of the argument. This may be a natural phenomenon. As the mayor said, maybe it's volcanoes. I think you will find several members of the former majority party of the Congress of the United States and some large energy company executives in this group. There are some that are concerned, but it isn't a problem to them personally. They're the ones that say, look, I'm worried about trans fats in my diet, about my kids' education, about the noise coming from my Volvo's transmission, about potential earthquakes and the leak in my basement. I, frankly, just don't have any emotional capacity to take on any more problems. And by the way, since I was planning to move to a warmer climate when I retired, maybe it's not such a bad problem that it's going to get warmer in San Francisco. There are those who are convinced that it's a problem, but they say, there's little we can do about it. What does it matter what San Francisco, the Bay Area, California, even the United States does if China and India keep pumping pollutants into the air? There are some that are convinced that it is a serious problem, but don't know what we as individuals or the organizations or corporations we work for can constructively do about it. I think that largely takes in where a lot of us are today. And then finally, there are the entrepreneurs. Those are the folks who realize there's either money to be made or cost to be avoided by getting out in front of the competition on this issue. And this group we find a lot of in the Bay Area where we have a lot of innovative businesses. Now, I hope there's something in my comments for everybody in each of these categories today, but I think we should keep that in mind. Ben, can we get the next slide? Okay, there we go. This is San Francisco Bay. It's upside down, but from Australia's perspective, that's just fine. It is the largest estuary on the West Coast. I hope this isn't an omen of all of the slides because we're going to all have to turn funny. It's the largest estuary on the West Coast of both the North and South American continents. It's a region that is home to about 7 million people. It's beautiful. It's prosperous. It's a spectacular place. And this is my beat. This is where I work. Now, this is the bay back in the middle of the 19th century. The yellow area shows where the bay used to be, where the tidal wetlands were. It used to be much bigger than it is today. But siltation from hydraulic gold mining, diking to create salt ponds and duck hunting clubs, garbage dumps along the shoreline of the bay, and frankly, landfill operations to create real estate, reduced the size of the bay by about a third between 1849 and 1960. And that's when the United States Army Corps of Engineers produced this map. It was intended to show that it was economically feasible and, in fact, desirable to fill another 60% of the bay. That was their intention. Instead, when this map was published, it alarmed the public, and it motivated them to take action to prevent the bay from becoming little more than a broad river. They didn't like what the Corps had predicted. The science fiction writer Ray Bradbury says that the purpose of science fiction isn't to predict the future. It's to prevent the future that's described. I don't think the Corps of Engineers intended this report to fall into the category of great science fiction, but that's what happened. The present-day bay looks more like this. This BCDC was created to stop the uncontrolled filling of the bay, and we've done that. In fact, We've reversed the shrinking of the bay. It's now 8,000 acres larger than it was 40 years ago, and the conversion of salt ponds in the North and South Bay to wetlands will make it another 26,000 acres larger. We are very proud of what we've accomplished. Not all government agencies know what they're supposed to do. Fewer even do it. We do. Well, our smug self-adulation was interrupted last year in March when the California Climate Change Center published a report titled Changing Climate, Assessing the Risk for California. The report looked at three scenarios for cutting the amounts of emission that we pump into the atmosphere. And depending on whether and how much greenhouse gas emissions can be brought under control, the report projects by the end of the century, average temperatures in California will rise between 3 and 10.5 degrees centigrade. One of the most publicized impacts of global warming is a predicted increase in sea level. And here's a graph showing sea level rise in San Francisco Bay. Now, I want to note one very important fact about this graph. It does not show predicted sea level rise. It shows how much the level of the bay has risen over the past century. Since 1900, the bay waters have risen 7 inches. And we at BCDC have been monitoring this increase for decades, and we've been especially concerned because ground elevation, particularly in the South Bay, is sinking because of groundwater extraction. So even if there's no sea level rise, we expect more flooding as the low-lying areas continue to sink. Therefore, over 20 years ago, we published a report warning of a dangerous sea level rise in the Bay Area. And the predictions that we made then have shown, unfortunately, to be pretty accurate as to what's happening. So for us in the Bay Area, reports about sea level rise don't belong in the science prediction section of the library. They belong over in the history section. It's happening here. The same California climate change report I mentioned predicts sea level increases of between 4 inches and 3 feet, 1 meter, by 2100. Now, since the bay has risen 7 inches in the past century, and the amount of greenhouse gases being emitted are continuing, it's hard for me to understand how we could only have a 3-inch rise in the next 100 years. But if you want to understand, ask Leslie Lako. She understands very clearly. If it turns out that sea level rise is closer to 3 feet over the next century, here are two maps. The one on the left shows what the bay looked like in 1849. The other one shows what it looked like in 2100. Now, as you see, they look pretty much the same. And that's the good news, because the bay surface that was lost to diking and filling in the first century after California became a state would once again become part of the bay. The bad news is we have built all kinds of very expensive stuff that's critical to civilization in the Bay Area on most of that filled land. And let me show you a few examples. This is San Francisco International Airport. The dark blue is where the bay is now. The light blue is where it will be with a 1 meter rise in sea level. That's Oakland International Airport. Clearly, Boeing should be building seaplanes. That's Silicon Valley. Now, just for fun, we mapped the San Francisco Public Utility Commission's wastewater treatment system. Well, you see, a lot of it's along the shoreline. So we've used some GIS projections, and we've had to use a 2-meter sea level rise because of the base maps we've used. But you see, let's look at the next one. A lot of that area would be inundated. Now, even if it's only half as much, there's still a lot of expensive PUC infrastructure that's going to be underwater. Now, under the heading of sharing the pain, I want to point out that BCDC's objectives will also be hard hit by sea level rise. Over the past 40 years, we've required a lot of public access along the shoreline of the bay, about 100 miles of it. And a lot more access has been provided in public parks and through the Bay Trail project. Much of this could well be lost. Now, after all this talk of doom and gloom, I have to put an important caveat in here. Bay waters won't rise slowly like and evenly like water filling a bathtub. The tide comes in, the tide goes up. So what we're talking about are trends in mean sea level. I prefer to use the term climate change to global warming when we're talking about this phenomenon we're dealing with, because overall, while the Earth's atmosphere will be getting warmer, some places will be getting hotter, others will be getting cooler, and the climate will become much more erratic. Some years, the Bay Area may go through extended droughts. Others years, we may get unusually heavy rainfall. And it's during these storms that we'll face the most serious problems. Because when rainfall runs off the hillsides into the bay, and that water piles up on top of a high tide, and that high tide is on top of sea level rise, and the winds push all that water across the bay, so that it acts as a dam to the additional water that's running off from the hills, that's when we'll see extensive damage, and we will see it far more often, as it shows. Now, in addition to sea level rise, the climate change is expected to result in more precipitation in the Sierra Nevada falling as rain, less as snow, and an earlier snowmelt. And this will reduce the spring and summer runoff, which will allow salinity levels and salt water to extend about 9 miles farther into the delta than it does now. Now, I don't think I need to remind you that a lot of folks in the Central Valley and Southern California get their water through the delta, and they expect that it will be fresh rather than salty. Well, now that I've completely depressed you, let me give you the good news. Even though I showed you a map of San Francisco International Airport underwater in 2100, it won't happen. San Francisco won't become the Venice of the West. Silicon Valley won't become the lost city of Atlantis. And salt water won't come out of the taps in Southern California. Why? Because however much it costs, we can't afford to allow this to happen. So we'll build levees around the airports. We'll build a seawall along the San Francisco waterfront. Flood control is already being incorporated into the planning for the salt pond to wetland conversion project in the South Bay. And we'll change the way we store and move fresh water around California. Economically, we don't have any other choice. But the cost will be enormous. And where we'll get the money and what other important investments and expenditures we'll have to forego to afford this are the bigger questions. But we do have other choices. There may be some areas along the bay shoreline where it's more cost effective to remove existing development and replace it with flood-absorbing wetlands than it is to protect the low-value structures. There may be areas, particularly in the delta, where it's better to halt planned development than it is to allow the development to be built and then face the cost of trying to protect it from inevitable flooding. Clearly, what we have to do is figure out how much it will cost to protect everything that's vulnerable to flooding, figure out how much everything that might flood is worth, and then develop a thoughtful regional strategy that effectively deals with this issue. We also have the choice of moving aggressively to reduce greenhouse gases so the sea level rise we have to deal with is at the lower end of the spectrum that the scientists tell us we should be planning for. It's too late to prevent climate change and sea level rise. They're already happening. And even if we shut down all the power plants and park all of our cars, there's so much greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, it will continue to get warmer. In many ways, we're in the same position as the captain of the Titanic was. What was his name? Edward J. Smith. At the speed he was going, by the time he saw the iceberg, it was inevitable that he would hit it, no matter what he did. But we can cushion the blow. We hope that just as the 1960 Army Corps of Engineers map, which showed how small the bay could become, galvanized citizens to take action, our maps showing how much bigger it might be will bring the message home that climate change is real, that it will affect each of us personally, and that we have to do something about it. California can be justifiably proud of the leadership position we've taken in our efforts to reduce greenhouse gases. It is my humble opinion that President George W. Bush would have never acknowledged climate change in his State of the Union speech last week had it not been for what California did. If we can enlighten the president, surely China and India will listen. In a little over a year, climate change has exploded from an issue most people doubted existed to an issue everyone wants to do something about. And I think we are now in the phase of trying to figure out what everybody else is doing so we don't trip over each other and can figure out where we fit into solving the puzzle. This summit is a very important step in this process. I thank you for inviting me. We at BCDC look forward to continuing to work with you, both because we should and because we must. Al Gore got it right. He says, dealing with climate change is not so much an environmental, scientific, political, or economic issue as it is a moral one. At some point, our children or our grandchildren will ask us, how could you have not seen what was happening, and why didn't you do more to stop it? We have to be able to look them in the eyes and say truthfully, as soon as we recognize the problem, we did everything we could to solve it. Thank you for giving me the privilege of talking with you today.
Just while I'm waiting for the slides to come up, I'd just like to say good morning to everybody. It's a great privilege for me to be here. It's going to be a very exciting 2 days for me, and I hope for all of you as well. And just say thank you very much to the organisers for inviting me today. I'm David Barnforth from MWH, and I'm going to talk a little bit, or share some of the experiences, rather, about what's been going on in the UK, and to try and help also for me to share some of the things that's been going on here as well. Thank you. In talking about what we've been doing in the UK in relation to adaptation strategies for flooding and coastal defence, I want to talk through a few of the strategic projects that we've been undertaking. One of them for the UK water industry, looking at climate change in relation to urban flooding. The Foresight Project, which is a UK government project looking at climate change, flooding and coastal defence. A government guidance note on planning, talking about making space for water in urban design. The construction industry in the UK's design guidance for managing extreme events or managing exceedance. And finally, the government's policy guidance in the UK on integrated approaches to urban drainage. Now, the picture on climate change is all too familiar. This is a graph of projected global warming and temperature rise as it affects Northwest Europe, and particularly the UK. It's a very similar picture to the one you have here, and it predicts, however you account for the uncertainty, a very significant rise in temperature over the next 50 to 100 years. The result of that average temperature rise of at least 3 degrees centigrade is that we are going to see warmer, wetter winters, drier, hotter summers, a sea level rise probably in excess of something like 800 millimetres, probably about 850 millimetres in the southeast of England. But hidden underneath that are perhaps some much more important messages. That temperature rise overall will lead to much stormier weather. So when we get rainfall, we're likely to see, particularly and interestingly in the summer months, much more intense rainfall in the future than we see today. And on top of any sea level rise, as Will mentioned, increase in storm surges, which will exacerbate the effect of that sea level rise even more. And what we've been looking at is, what does that mean? If that occurs, how might we adapt our urban areas to cope with this? And that's really the underlying message of the projects that we've been looking at. At the present time, we have something in excess of 80,000 properties at immediate risk from flooding within urban areas in the UK. The annual damage cost at the moment is something like £270 million. That's about $500 million per annum. And the annual cost currently of flood mitigation is of the order of £320 million. That's a huge sum of money that's already invested in flood protection works in the UK. When we look at the impact of climate change, and particularly the effect on the sort of storm events that lead to flooding in urban areas and indeed to some extent in rural areas as well, we are looking in the UK at something up to around 40% increase in rainfall intensity. And when we model that effect on our urban drainage systems, on our river channels, we see that that will lead to something, understandably, of the order of a 40% increase in the flows in those drainage systems. But because those drainage systems are already nearing capacity, that has a disproportionate effect on the amount of flooding and the amount of damage that might occur. We expect to see a 100% increase in flood volumes on the surface. That's a doubling of flood volume. 130% increase in the number of properties affected, and a 200% increase in the damage of that flooding. That's a threefold increase in damage costs. That's just looking at that fairly narrow band of flood control and damage to property in urban areas. One of the difficulties of trying to look at the future is the uncertainty of what the futures might look like. And this graph is taken from the government's foresight project on flooding and coastal defence and the effects of climate change. There are four bands on here. The left-hand band is the present scenario. That's a summary of the average annual damage as a result of flooding in the UK. And then we have four other bands, and these are for four future scenarios. This is looking at really the world economic environment and how that might change in the future. The left is an economic environment that is based on world markets driving the economy. The next one is based on natural enterprise driving the economy. The next one is a one of local ownership, everything reducing really to be a self-interest regional economy. And the right is an economy that's driven basically on the basis of environmental protection. Our feeling at the moment is that it's the second of those that's the most likely. That's the national enterprise one. And we can see that if we look at that, that there's going to be a very substantial increase in flooding in the future. And within that, that the biggest increase is likely to occur within our urban environment. So that although we will see a very significant increase in flooding due to river flooding and flooding due to coastal impacts, the biggest cause or biggest increase in flooding in the future is likely to be within the urban area. And what we've been wrestling with is, how might we start to adapt to that? How might we cope with that future rise? Thank you. This one shows the number of properties affected. And what's interesting about this one is there isn't the same difference between the future assumptions, that irrespective of how we see global economy developing, we're likely to see something of the order of 4 to 5 times the number of properties affected by flooding in the future if we continue with our current levels of investment on tackling that flooding. We have exactly the same picture if we look at coastal defence. I'm just struggling to read the actual... Yes, that's a coastal... So if we look at coastal impacts as well, that shows the same sort of picture, although the increases are perhaps more dramatic. We're seeing here something like an 8- to 10-fold rise in the number of properties affected and the damage associated from coastal inundation. So how might we deal with some of this? Well, one of the things the projects have been looking at is what would be the implication of continuing with our current policy of managing urban drainage, managing river flooding, and managing coastal defence. And what we can see is that the storage solutions for dealing with problems in urban areas, the cost of those would be likely to increase something between 2 and 4 times present-day values. If we move from a policy of storage retention to increased conveyance, we can contain that cost a little bit. The cost rises are not so high there, 2 to 2.3 times present-day values, but that does not account for the impact on the urban communities, the disruption and loss of commercial business that would be caused by that reconstruction of our drainage systems. Equally, in terms of environmental impact, if we were to control the discharges from combined sewer overflows to present-day impact standards, then we will be looking at something of 3 to 10 times the cost of managing the discharges from combined sewer overflows. And as has already been said today, given that our investment in infrastructure is competing in urban areas with other investments for education, for police, and so on, it's very unlikely that all of that money is going to be available to deal with urban protection against climate change from flooding. So the conclusion there is it is unlikely that any of the conventional strategies in themselves are going to be feasible in the future long term because of the impacts of climate change. I'd like to give some examples of some slightly alternative solutions that are being proposed now and how those might change and some of the headline solutions which might take us forward then. The first message is that when we're looking to control river flooding and urban flooding, then conveyance is likely to become more popular than storage and attenuation schemes. And this shows a length of completely new river that's been built to the west of London. This is the Jubilee River. It's essentially a duplication of the River Thames, entirely artificial, and it's been used to convey additional flows out to the lower areas of the River Thames to protect property to the west of London. We are likely to see more conveyance solutions of this type be constructed in the future. Many of you will be familiar with the Thames Barrage project. This has now been in operation for quite a number of years and essentially protects the whole of the central London area from rising sea levels and storm surges. This will have to be replaced with a much bigger barrier in the future, and plans are already in place to start on assessing the feasibility of that, how it might be constructed and what it might cost. But the investment in that will be absolutely enormous. And to follow Will's point, one of the things we're learning is that it will be totally impossible to defend all coastal areas from projected sea level rise in the future. It is only the high value areas where we will be able to afford such protection from coastal changes. In our urban areas as well, as I said, we will not be able to afford simply to increase the size of our infrastructure to deal with the increased storm events we'll see as a result of climate change. This is a picture of severe flooding of the centre of Glasgow in Scotland in 2002. And you can see actually that the contribution that the drainage system is making here. You can see the water bubbling out, not bubbling out, but streaming out of the drainage system onto the surface. Analysis of this flood event showed that the urban drainage system was full to capacity in approximately 20 minutes into the storm. It only conveyed of something like 20% of the flood water. The storm lasted for about 4 hours. 80% of the flood flow was conveyed on the surface. This is a good example. This was a 100-year event. This is a good example of the sorts of extreme events that we're going to see much more frequently in our urban areas. Our urban drainage systems already are incapable of conveying most of the floodwater that arises from intense storms. And they're likely to be even less likely, if able, so to carry that in the future. So how are we going to cope with that aspect? What we're starting to look at in the UK is how do we design our urban areas better so that these flood flows can be managed above ground, recognising that this major above ground drainage system is going to have to play a key role in conveying stormwater in the future by creating flood pathways, by making space between buildings and properties, and even by identifying sacrificial areas which are allowed to flood during the more extreme events. So we're starting to think now of looking into wider aspects and different aspects of flooding and more novel and integrated solutions. So the last part I want to say is related to a fairly new project which is being piloted now in the UK, which is looking at a much wider and integrated approach towards managing flooding. And I want to show this in an urban environment, but it applies just the same to rivers and to coastal defence. And I'd like to perhaps explain a little bit about why integrated approaches are important. This is a picture of a relatively small area of flooding in the north of England. There's four pictures here, and I'd just like to take you through them. The first is in the top left, shows the source of the flooding. This actually was a flooding in winter, and it arose because a large area of undeveloped land, largely rural land, got completely waterlogged, and then during an intense storm event, large volumes of water washed off that area down into the developed area, into the urban area. The responsibility for managing that drainage lies with the local drainage authority, which is a drainage board. It flowed onto highways in the area. You see in the top right picture, highway flooding. The responsibility for draining the highway is the local highway authority. It then flowed into the properties on the left of the picture. As soon as it crossed past the wall there into the property, the responsibility for that drainage shifted to the drainage, the responsibility of the local water company, which is a private company responsible in part for draining property. It went in through the front doors of those properties, it went down one floor and came out through the back doors, as we can see in the bottom left-hand picture, and drained off. And underneath, as we see in the bottom right there, behind some of the properties, is also an underground culvert, which also burst open, causing flooding. That is the responsibility of the local, a different local drainage authority. There are four different agencies involved with managing this very simple and localised flooding event. And you'll see in the top right the people looking rather despondently over the wall. They don't actually care who has responsibility for managing this flooding. They just want the problem fixed. And if we don't get the different stakeholders around the table with their different responsibilities, different legal responsibilities, different jurisdictions, to actually start to develop integrated approaches, we will not be able to serve the public properly, and we will not be able to adequately cope with climate change effects. The second reason why integrated approaches are important is that in almost all cases, urban flooding is very, very complex. It might be due, as the top left picture shows, to overloading of the drainage infrastructure within the urban area. As the top right-hand picture shows, it might be due to coastal inundation. Or as the bottom picture shows, it might be due to river flooding. Most likely, in many areas, it will be due to all three occurring simultaneously. And the actual technical complexities of that, and how we address that from an engineering perspective, is very difficult. Despite all our advanced modelling tools, we still have some way to go, firstly, to properly explain all those interactions, and secondly, to be able to develop a proper engineered, integrated solution to those problems. And then thirdly, one of the problems we have with flood protection is that drainage engineers and flood protection engineers for many, many years in the developed world have been working in their own compartment. As the picture shows, this has always been the way we did our urban drainage planning. But what we're beginning to realise is that we have to think about this in the much wider context of urban areas and recognise that there are other agencies involved, not just the drainage agencies. There's the transportation agencies, the planning agencies, health and social services, and so on. When we start to get these agencies around the table, all working together for common objectives, we have a much better chance of coping with some of the challenges that we have to face. And finally, what this graph shows, again, are these four future scenarios on the right. We've seen the orange ones before, the potential effects of conventional solutions. Current scenario on the left-hand side, very graphical representation of the challenges we face. But in yellow, we see the potential of integrated approaches. What this shows is that if we get all the agencies together, all the stakeholders together, and we get an integrated understanding of the technicalities of the problem, then we have a chance at developing solutions that will cope with future climate change in a way that may just about be affordable. So overall, I'd like to conclude with just a few key messages. Firstly, that conventional approaches to flood protection are probably going to be unsustainable in the long term in the light of climate change. Secondly, the very extreme events do need to be managed. We need to start thinking about how do we manage flood water on the ground. Thirdly, that conveyance is likely to be more cost effective than the more traditional storage attenuation solutions in the future. Coastal protection is only likely to be affordable to protect high value areas. Urban flooding must be managed above ground as well as below ground. And that integrated approaches are the way forward. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. Looks like the slides are ready. My name is Tom Franza. I'm the Assistant General Manager for the Wastewater Enterprise of San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. And I really appreciate the opportunity today to speak to you about a very specific problem we face in San Francisco with rising sea level. The previous speakers, I think, have done an excellent job giving an overview of what we might expect to happen with climate change. And I wanted to bring up a very specific problem and how we might approach that, hopefully to let all of you see what we're doing and perhaps generate a lot of discussion later about people who have similar problems and what we might all do to resolve this. So here we are, San Francisco, surrounded by lots of water. I want to show you a bit about how San Francisco's wastewater system works and then how rising sea level will impact that. We have a combined sewer system. San Francisco's system started to be built in the 1860s, so it's pretty well been built out by the 1930s or 40s. It was built as a combined sewer system. And what that means is that the sanitary sewage flow and runoff from streets and storm drainage all flows in the same pipes. The system is built now with a large storage and transport system, the idea being we collect, on a rainy day, we can collect a lot of the storm water, store it in the system, and then treat it later when the rain stops. So this little diagram shows you basically how the system would work. On a dry day, most of the sewage would be coming down the pipe. It would be flowing into the big transport structures that exist around the city, probably flowing right at the bottom of these very large structures. They're on the order of dozens of feet wide and dozens of feet deep. And they have little sloped bottoms and Q nets at the bottom where most of the dry weather sewage flows all the time. That wastewater is transported to the treatment plants. On a rainy day, those transport storage structures, a large structure represented in the center of the picture, start to fill, and they fill dramatically. It always amazes me to watch a flow gauge or a level gauge on one of these structures. Just to give you an idea of their size, if any of you are familiar with the Great Highway out by Ocean Beach, there's one of these structures that runs under the Great Highway that's about 2 miles long, about 40 feet wide, and about 40 or 50 feet deep, and it can hold 50 million gallons of runoff. That thing, I can watch the level gauge on our monitoring station just creep up when the rains start to hit hard. So the amount of water that we handle in a storm is absolutely tremendous. Well, what will happen is we have plants and pumps that can pump this large volume of water to a large degree to our treatment plants, where we can give it, in many cases, full secondary treatment. But on very peak storm days, and this is something that the other speakers have brought up, how these intense storms are problematic for us. When we get a big storm, we're pumping and treating all we can, but we don't have enough capacity to handle all the water. So what will happen is these structures will fill, and then they will discharge. We call that a combined sewer discharge into the bay or to the ocean. I want you to take note of that pipe that's represented going out to the right there where we drain into the ocean. There's where we start to get into our problem with rising sea level. This is a little bit bigger representation of the slide Will showed that was showing the bay side of the city. This is sort of our transport storage structure around the entire city. We call it a moat. It's the way we collect rainwater for later treatment. And as I said, in light to moderate storms, we can do a pretty good job of collecting all of the rainwater and sanitary sewage and running it through the treatment plants. In fact, there are probably, in terms of calendar days, there might be 14 or 15 calendar days a year where we would actually have a combined sewer discharge, and those would be in the heaviest storms. Around this moat structure in the city, there are 36 outfalls. These would be the overflow points when the system fills to capacity and we can't treat anymore. The west side of the city doesn't present an immediate problem for us yet because of its elevation. It's a bit higher than we think will be impacted in the next, say, 30 to 50 years by rising sea level. It's the bay side of the city where we anticipate some problems. This is a photo. It's a little bit difficult to see, but you know, stormy days are kind of gray and dreary and tough to get a bright picture of this. But what you're seeing here is one of our combined sewer discharge structures. And what you're seeing is the discharge of combined sewage on a very heavy rain day, probably 90 to 95% rainwater and a blended with domestic sewage of about 5%. I want you to note where you see the sewage coming out of this structure, and if we go to the next slide, I want to compare that with the sea level. The trend you see here you've seen before. It's data that clearly shows a historical trend of rising sea level. There's just no doubt about that. And on the left-hand side of the picture, I wanted to represent at the far left the transport storage structure. The bay would be on the right side of the dark blue bar, and the dark blue line, the gap represents the weir. That's where the overflow point would be. So if we progress on with our projections of where sea level is going, the horizontal red bar represents the lowest elevation of our current weir structures. If we look at IPCC projections, for example, of where tides are going, it doesn't take too long, not too many years, maybe about 2013, 2014, we get to a point where at peak tides we have very regular occurrences of bay water actually topping the weir and coming back into our system. Maybe I can. We can go on to the next. The bad news is we actually see this happening now. The photo on the left is that same structure you saw discharging in a previous slide. The weir structures are the slots underneath. The lower right photo, you're seeing a high tide that is actually not happening on a stormy day, not when we're having a lot of wind and tidal surge. It's just a very high tide that's actually topping over the weir and coming back into our system. The problem that we face, I think, is represented very well here in that is in that if this becomes, right now this is maybe a several days a year event. Probably it occurs for several hours and then stops. And so we can sort of deal with that. The issue is, though, if this starts to become a daily occurrence, which it could well be with a sea level rise of a foot or a foot and a half, not that much, then we have big problems. I noticed a lot of my wastewater colleagues in the audience, and I think we all understand what the problem is. It's really simply stated as two things. Our treatment facilities aren't designed to handle salt water. We have biological treatment systems that operate in a freshwater mode, saltwater intrusion. And actually, we've had this happen to us in San Francisco, where we've had a breach of our system. It was about 15 years ago, I think, and we had huge influx of salt water into the system. The chloride levels got very high in the influent to the plants, and that produced great stress on the biological treatment systems to the point that we were worried that we were going to lose the entire treatment system for a period of time. And once you lose a biological system like that, it takes some time to regenerate itself. Luckily, we avoided that problem. So one issue is with a lot of salt water entering the system, our current state of treatment processes just won't work very well, if at all. The second problem you have is basically your sewer system is full of bay water. So if you do have a storm or a rain event coming, then you get back to the surface drainage problem that David talked about. The surface drainage won't have anywhere to go. And obviously, big problems with that. Go ahead, if we can go to the next slide. Clearly, if we would allow that to happen, we could easily experience huge flooding problems, backups in areas of the city that are susceptible to this sort of intrusion. On the next slide, I want to talk a little bit about the way the system is designed. If you're going to have to allow for overflows, because you're going to just not be able to treat everything that comes at you, your weir levels have to be, you know, in the past, I mean, these things were designed a long time ago, at an assumed, where there's an assumed sea level, and so you would set your weirs at a point higher than that, so at any sort of high tides, you wouldn't expect to have any sort of inflow into the system. But the weirs have to be set low enough so that if you have a large inundation, the drainage will happen in a manner that won't cause a backup in the system and then flood properties and streets like you saw in the previous slide. We have ways of preventing the backflow, and that's what we really have to look at in the next little while. In fact, we have a 30-year master plan that we're working on now that's looking at this problem of inflow into the system from high tides in a very serious way. We believe we probably have to start implementing some backflow prevention measures, I'd say within the next several years, probably 3 to 5 years, because it's already happening now and it's just going to get worse. So some of the things we could probably do would be, for example, these are we call them duckbill valves that we could install on some of our weirs. Sounds simple enough, but if you remember the configuration of the weir I just showed you, that it's quite, they're quite long, and we don't have too many sort of pipes, small pipes like this that just end, and you could put a duckbill on the end to prevent the flow from coming in. But conceptually, you could do this with our long weirs. We could see the next slide. Here's here's another example of a long weir structure. This is sort of south of Monster Park along the bay. And on the lower left, you can see sort of the weir arrangement as it currently exists. And one of our concepts would be to, it's a little bit hard to see, but you could sort of wall off those existing weirs and put some sort of a duckbill type of a backflow prevention in there. So we see this as a near-term solution to a current problem we have, something we can start doing right away. And I think my engineers suggest that this would probably protect us, I'd say, for the next 30 to 50 years. If this is all we did, we could probably avoid serious problems with saltwater intrusion. When you start looking at the longer term, I don't really know what you do other than install more pumps. Will talked about, this is a problem we have to stop. We might have to build seawalls around the city. We might have to berm up large areas. We're just going to have to pump a lot more. And I guess sort of the discussion point I have about more pumping is, conceptually, that's simple to do. But for the longest time, we've been talking about, and we're talking about this in our master planning efforts, is the notion of sustainability and lowering greenhouse gas emissions, in essence, not using more electricity. Let's use gravity and other things to do what we have to do. Unfortunately, now that we have this climate change problem and rising tides and so on, it kind of turns us around, where you know, one sort of solution that you just think of is more pumps, but how is that becoming more sustainable? I don't really know what the answer is yet, and I think that's why we, convene summits like this. I think all of us are going to be facing very similar kinds of situations, and it's the kind of thing we all need to think through together and figure out how to resolve. So to recap, the specific problem from a utility management point of view that we face in the near future is the notion of saltwater backflowing into our current sewer system. This will basically cause our treatment systems to fail catastrophically. We will have, for large periods of time, sewers that are completely full, which will not allow surface drainage to happen in a successful way. And having said that, I think there is a way we can resolve that problem in the immediate future. It won't be cheap to sort of do a backflow prevention around the east side of the city. We're looking at preliminary estimates in the area of maybe $10 to $20 million to retrofit this kind of thing. If you go out to 2100, where you're constructing seawalls and adding more pumps or doing whatever it is that needs to be done without some sort of major breakthrough in new technology in the next 100 years, I don't know what those costs would be. I imagine they'd be very, very large. So with that, I hope that will trigger some discussion, get everyone thinking about some of the problems we're going to face. There are many more problems than this, but I just wanted to highlight one as an example for everyone. So thank you for letting me discuss this with you today, and we'll proceed with the discussion period.
Okay, I'm going to come back up here just so I can spot people in the audience. I understand there are staff with cordless mics around available to come to your seat if you want to speak. I'd just like to start the discussion off with a couple of points. First of all, you know, we went pretty quickly from optimism and and a high level of discussion about measures that could be taken to change things. And I work for a mayor who's an optimist, too, and I just love it. And I love it when he announces goals like, 20% renewables by 2010 or rollback by to 1990 levels, because it gives us all the permission that we need to go out and do dramatic things. But then you also have to listen to the people who actually make these systems work and talk to them about what it costs and what they're going to be facing. And I think one of the more important points that may have slid past you that both Will and David made was and really needs to be thought about is that the investment decisions are going to be made based on protecting the highest value properties. This is why the issue of global warming and sea level rise has been seen as an environmental justice issue internationally and nationally from the very beginning by some people who were thinking about the social implications of all of this as well, because we're not just talking about some abstract way of assigning dollars to particular geographical areas. We're talking about neighborhoods and people that will be sacrificed or at least not receive the same level of attention as others will. And in the urban areas where we tend to have the greatest extremes of wealth and poverty and of neighborhoods that are or facilities that are absolutely must be protected at all costs versus areas that are more marginal, this is going to become a very contentious area for debate at the political level. Similarly, when we talk about the amounts of money that are going to need to be invested, don't sound maybe that huge right now, but an ongoing and going forward basis, they are gigantic investments that we're talking about. And those are not necessarily the glamorous investments to be making. They're not the ribbon-cutting projects that people like to get their pictures taken in front of. But at the same time, the people who are the political appointees, and I think we've seen that in other places, who are standing there at the time that the polluted floodwaters are rising, are going to be the ones who are going to be viewed as having been the villains, even if they weren't there, 20, 30 years before when the decisions were being made about what to protect and how to do it. So we face some really tough decisions that have to be made right now. And the people in this room are, many of them, the people who are going to be making them, or at least informing the people who are going to be making them. So it's, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but I'd really welcome your thoughts and comments right now. Is anybody ready to jump in? Go ahead.
Thanks. Oh. Hi, Mary. Greg Zlotnick, Santa Clara Valley Water District. And I was struck by the program today, and this is something we struggle with in these things all the time. Who's not here in the choir? There's no one here from a land use jurisdiction or people that make those decisions. We will engineer our way out as best we can, but as we keep overlaying these things. And how do we deal with that issue and break through to those decision makers where they're focused on economic development rather than how do you stop causing the problem that we're all going to have to fix? And Will's comment about river flows, we have it in the South Bay. How are we going to deal with the fact that sea level rise is going to create Katrinas all over the country, in essence, in terms of rivers not having anywhere to go?
Thanks. Will, you want to start with that?
Sure. Thanks, Greg. As Greg knows, we've been working very hard to bring the water agencies and the land use planning agencies and the environmental community and the business community together. And our problem is that we have 24-hour days when we need about 106-hour days to do all that. But I think you're absolutely right. And Mary's point about the political difficulty of making some of these decisions, and we're seeing this in New Orleans, the first reaction is put it all back together the way it was before. And if you're not willing to do that, you're a racist. And we have to acknowledge that the status quo is a very conscious decision with very high costs associated with it some benefits, but we need to factor that in. I think it is extraordinarily difficult politically to get out in front on that issue and get reelected. Ironically, I think who will save us? I always like to say there's no morality in the bottom line, and probably the most immoral of institutions is the insurance industry. And I think what they will do is just say, I'm sorry. As we look at our money and where we can put it, we are not going to put it into insuring areas that are susceptible to flooding over and over again. And if you can't get the insurance, you can't get the financing, you can't build it. And that may give us the political cover to do the right thing.
Thank you. David, could you comment from the UK perspective about how you got all the people into that nice little sandbox together?
Well, firstly, the last thing I would want to give the impression of is that we've got it all sorted in the UK, because we haven't. So if we just get that out of the way first, okay? I think we are struggling with exactly this issue. It is so difficult to get all the different stakeholders around, let alone get them to agree to any sort of uniform action or plan. And the way we're trying to address this is to try it on pilot projects, because the major, trying to do it for a whole area is just too difficult. But if you try and do it for a particular part of an area, and you do have to do it by persuasion, and you do have to do it by push as well. So I guess the mayor perhaps here, I don't know your systems as well as I know the systems in the UK, but there does have to be a top-down push on this as well, quite honestly, to get everybody around the table. And you get them around the table, then you say, well, let's look at what if. You know, how would it look if we started to work together? And particularly if you can bring in some examples of successes where it's worked in other areas. What is actually fascinating when you do this is you start with people who have very entrenched positions. I'll give you an example. One of the strategies we're looking at in the UK for the more frequent extreme events that we can expect as a result of climate change is to start to really design highways as flood channels. And interestingly, a lot of the design guidance we're picking up is from the US. So we're actually taking some of your experiences and trying to adapt them for UK applications. Now, that position, our highway engineers said, no way. We're never going to do this. The concept of using highways as flood channels is a complete no-no. Until we started to bring out examples like the Glasgow floods and said, well, for most of this flood event, the highways acted as flood channels. Now, do you want that to be on an ad hoc basis, or do you want to start managing it? Because the interesting thing when you start to look at urban flooding is you learn a number of important lessons. Firstly, water flows downhill. Secondly, it accumulates in low spots. And again, I don't have anything like your experience of what it's like in the US, but in the UK, it's very interesting what you find in those low spots. First of all, you find that's where the low-income houses is. That's where the poor people live, the people who have no say, really, in what goes on in our urban community. So I was really pleased you made the point about environmental justice. And the second thing you find there, almost everywhere in the UK, is exactly where we put all our emergency services, because the land is cheap. So the first thing that gets knocked out is the fire department, your emergency response vehicles, your ambulances. All that disappears in the first half hour of the storm.
We use earthquake faults for that.
Okay. Well, you have this. But I do think this idea of the pilot project as a start-ups, because people then don't have to commit themselves so much. You get them working together on the pilot projects, and then you expand the lessons learned into wider schemes.
Thanks. Tom, do you want to chime in with any of your experiences so far with trying to bring folks together?
Well, certainly San Francisco has a problem along these lines as well. We've been looking at developments that, I mean, I guess I'd preface my statement by saying maybe with, echoing the mayor's comment about we should have started looking at this 10 years ago. 10 years ago, at least in my world, I don't know that we talked much about this kind of thing. And so we're seeing developments in San Francisco. I've talked to developers that said, gee, Tom, if anybody in the city would have told me to build my building 2 feet higher so it would drain right, I could have done that and it wouldn't have cost that much. It's just getting people working together and talking together. And We're making a move on that at the present time. It's a hard thing to do. There's lots of different departments with lots of different interests and visions. But, I mean, we've just got to keep pressing on with it. We've been somewhat successful with our planning department and building inspection in part departments, at least getting them to the table and making them. I think they're starting to understand the problem now. So that's a very good thing, and we just have to keep pressing on.
Thanks. Great question, Greg. Where are we with the microphone? Over here.
Dave Erickson, Climate Protection Campaign in Sonoma County. We're a nonprofit that's involved in looking at local solutions, and I'm finding it interesting that you're dealing with primarily, it seems, adaptation and what we're going to need to do going forward to adapt to effects. We've had a lot of success looking at mitigation, looking at it from the side of what we're going to have to do locally, basically, to address the causes of global warming. I wonder if you all could address what you see as being a proactive method for addressing solutions going forward to lowering GHG impacts incorporating these integrated planning elements that you've started to discuss.
Anybody want to tackle that one?
Well, I happen to have the good fortune of being in a room with the executive directors of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, the Association of Bay Area Governments, and the Bay Area Air Quality Management District the morning after Governor Schwarzenegger signed AB 32. And pragmatic people all, and they said, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter what California does. But to a person, they all said, but what this is about is leadership. It is anything you can do. Anything you can step forward on this, anything we can be doing to introduce this problem and solutions into the way we as a society make decisions, because that's what leadership is all about. And I think without taking that moral, spiritual step, nobody in the world is going to listen to us. And I think as we take that step, I'm so fortunate being here in the Bay Area with some of the most innovative, bright people that come up with wonderful solutions. I think we're going to be in a position of leading the world and really making a hell of a lot of money at it. So the short and cop-out answer is I think anything we can be doing to inject this decision at every point in our local political process, our planning process, our governmental process, our at using our leadership. I think that's the most important thing we can do.
Great question, and a great answer from Will, actually, which is I don't really have much to add, except to perhaps to reflect on my previous answer, and I think this is not a pilot project. I think as an engineer, It should not be easy to forget, though sometimes I think we do, that everything we do has that impact in terms of climate change. And it isn't just the energy that's consumed through extra pumping, it's the embedded energy, it's the embedded carbon emissions that's into everything we build. The more we build, the more concrete we cast, the greater the impact we have on the environment. In my view, and I think our company's belief generally, it isn't just looking at the flagship schemes that can demonstrate improvements in terms of environmental impacts. It's embedding that into every scheme you do, every single bit of development, integrated solutions, engineering design, whether it's a big scheme, a flagship project, or it's just a small scheme looking at local improvements. Every single thing you do, you have to embed this change in thinking into it.
Just adding on a little item, I mean, one thing we're looking at in our master planning effort is what we call low-impact development, and it's the unconcreting over of the city, basically, is one way I think about it, and what that does for you is hopefully reduce the amount of water you actually have to handle by pumping and treatment and so on. So it just has to be a fundamental component of everything you do.
I'd just like to maybe add from the chair's perspective here that what we're seeing in Los Angeles, I think, is that adding climate to the mix so that it's not just another box that you check off, but something that actually causes you to think differently about whatever the project or the problem is that's in front of you, sometimes causes you to break out of the paradigms that you've been in and to actually start addressing problems in a more holistic way. And if that's the case, then there is at least a small silver lining to this very dark cloud, that it will force us to do things that wise people have been suggesting we should do for a long time in terms of better planning. This over here and here.
The integrated response scenario, and in all the cases, the local ownership scenario had lower impacts in terms of climate change and sea level rise and damage. What is the difference between those two scenarios, and how is local ownership a better scenario than global sustainability?
Did everybody hear the question? You might want to just repeat it briefly.
It was essentially a question about the different scenarios and why. Do you want to go back? Okay, is that better? It was basically a question really about how the different global scenarios lead to different conclusions about what the future looked like, if I can put it like that. It probably would take quite a lot of explanation to deal with all of that, and maybe you and I can talk afterwards in a little bit more detail, but I think what's important to realise when we look at the future scenarios is it's looked at in more than one way. It's looked at both in terms of the economy and the impact on the environment. So when you're looking at evaluating different strategies against those future scenarios, you're looking at how those different scenarios not only influence the environment in terms of the number of carbon emissions and other residues that they produce, but also at how much money they are going to have available to invest in adaptation strategies. Because both the things are closely interlinked. So it isn't just looking at the impact side, it's looking at their capability of coping with climate change. So it's those two aspects that are rolled in together there. And perhaps that might, to some extent, help answer that question a little bit.
Good start. I expect the two of you can talk more after. There were some other hands over in this area. This way, okay.
Yeah, Mary, it seems that defining the problem is going to help drive what we look at as solutions. In your opening statements, you mentioned you have plants at 20 feet, and you're looking at numbers from 9 to 25 feet as a projection. Tom, you're looking at our big problem at 3 to 5 feet, and you're using a meter or slightly more as your projection. That's a big difference. If we're going to spend $500 million in the next couple of years in California for water in the Delta, and we miss the mark between 3 feet and 25 feet, we're going to be in a world of hurt, because that investment is going to look ridiculous. If it's just 8 feet of sea level rise, what's the consensus on sea level rise? If we're going to be designing solutions, what's the problem?
Good question. Anybody want to respond?
Well, I think that's the challenge, is how do you plan with all this uncertainty? Because if you use the lower projections and you end up spending an enormous amount of money building facilities that flood, you get fired. And if you use the higher projection and you end up spending tens of millions of dollars more than was really necessary to deal with the problem, you get fired.
And either way. What's the problem?
I think this is really the greatest challenge that we are facing, is we are introducing into systems that were set up to do one thing a whole new problem, and then laying uncertainty over it. Let me give you just a specific example. The agency I'm the executive director of was set up to keep San Francisco Bay from getting smaller, and we've done a phenomenal job of it over 40 years. But as we look to the future, the problem is that the bay is going to get bigger, which probably means we have to go back and institutionally re-engineer the whole agency, because it's dealing with a problem of the past, not of the future. I think at an engineering level, there are lots of those sorts of things that we're going to introduce into everything we do, and we're going to be giving people challenges and saying, but we don't know how much, but damn it, you better be right. I don't have an answer for it. I know the scientists continue to work to try to refine those numbers, and we keep waiting for the next report that is going to, well, there's one coming out Friday, and then there'll be another one in another month or so, in hopes that they will get it more precise. But I think the reality is in our lives, we won't know. Because if we're successful in mitigation, we will reduce the size of the problem. And if we aren't, it's going to get even worse than we think it is.
And I'd just like to add one thing to the conversation for Will. I brought one of my favorite prediction tools, my San Francisco crystal ball, so maybe I'll loan it to Will to help him try to figure this out a little better.
Hey, this is fantastic. We don't have these in the UK.
I think we call those snow domes. That's great.
I think that's a fantastic question, that one. Yeah, and which really is, how do we manage the uncertainty of it? I wish I had a fantastic answer, but I'll try. We can't know with any degree of precision what is going to happen in the future. So the way I think we try and approach this is, first of all, you have the types of solutions you look at are different, which I think is the point you were just making, is that you have solutions which are more adaptable. The nature of the solution that you use is more adaptable to future change, so you can adjust it as you go forward. And the second thing is, you move forward in increments. You don't try and plan a solution now for what is going to happen in 2080 or 2100. You start to go down the road within the bounds of current certainty and in a direction which takes you in the broader direction of the ultimate goal, so that you don't have to, as Will said, unpick in 20 years' time and re-engineer what we've done over the next 20 years, of this first 20 years. We have to just be certain enough now for, say, the next 20 years to make a start now. There's a danger that because we can't see into the future, we do nothing now. We have to act now.
Yeah, and I think the time scale is important, as well as the risk versus the expenditure issue. And this is one of the reasons why economists all over the world are also looking at these issues, as well as scientists and engineers, because there is at some point, I suppose, an amount of money which is beyond what is possible to spend, or at least what would be reasonable to spend. But since most of us, in fact, won't be around to be fired from whatever jobs we're currently holding at the time that these predictions really come to pass, we are going to have to make decisions now without really knowing how it's all going to turn out. I've been told that we have maybe two more minutes. If there's a really quick question, we can deal with it, and then we're going to have to get off stage.
Thank you. One of the things that we do is try to bring what little we know about climate change to bear on our capital program, which is very extensive and very driven by trying to stay up with evolving regulations. And I'm wondering how, as we try to rethink some of these projects, we're going to get the regulators to sync with us, because much of what we do, we're doing on a very tight timetable to come into compliance.
Very good question. How to educate regulators? Does anybody have an answer to that one?
Well, as a regulator, I will admit that we're aware of the problem and we are looking for innovative solutions. But actually, that question was one of the dumbest questions I've ever heard, and I'm going to have my driver answer.
I think the regulators, in my experience at least, are beginning to be aware that the single-purpose missions and the deadlines that drive them may not always lead to results that are going to be supportive of these issues that we're now raising. And while they may not know the answers, at least they're open to talking about it.
I think, again, the key thing is our regulations are created in reaction to a problem of the past. And the most difficult thing will be to get we, the regulators, and everybody else to turn around and look to the future.
And that's going to take getting it back to the political process, because these regulators are not driven by their own imaginations. They're usually implementing statutes and responding to very important public imperatives.
First is a general part to the answer. It is to get everybody around the table and have an integrated approach. And recognize that a lot of groundwork has to be done in facilitating that, in resolving the inherent conflicts that are there, because we're not used to sitting round the table with regulators necessarily and reaching a consensus on how to go forward. It's not the traditional way of working in many areas. But secondly, I think to recognise is what drives the regulators. The regulators are there as an agency and are usually accountable to the public through the political process. And if you can understand the drivers behind the regulator, they're concerned that if they don't invoke certain regulations, they'll be liable, they'll be answerable to the public, and we have to help them with that issue. So we have to see this as a two-way process of facilitating this, bringing together the different agencies.
Together. I'm being dragged off stage, I think, at this point. Oh, Tom, did you have one last point? No. All right. We are due to take a break and to be back, I believe, at 11:30. Is that correct? No, I'm wrong. All right. Let's hear from our leader then. Thanks.
I don't know about you, but I believe this has been a great panel. So please show them your appreciation. Thank you all for your questions. And Mary, thank you for you and your group here to give us some real good thoughts, ideas. You are to be back at a little before 11:15 because we want you in your seats at 11:15. So take a quick break. There's more muffins, coffee, juice.